these issues, because the young are not given the education which they usually most need. But this law of polarity, therefore, comes in so many places, breaking through the structure of society and giving us constant evidence that it is operating. Now, in the law of polarity, of course, we also have the laws which bring human beings together in various relationships, friendship, marriage, parent-children relationships. For nearly always, these are subtly or factually polarizing. We know in psychology that all relationships have, to a measure, a polar foundation. We know also man's natural desire as a human being to unite with the polar opposite, not only for purposes of the perpetuation of the species, but also for association, comfort, inspiration, and understanding. All these factors indicate man's sense of incompleteness and emphasize the importance of polarity. Now, this again leads to one of the more profound philosophical observations on the subject. Namely, that polarity lies in the sphere of manifestation rather than in the sphere of substance. Things must physically or objectively appear polarized. But in their nature and substance, all things are in themselves in equilibrium. The spirit of man is forever in equilibrium. Therefore, the spirit of man must be and is an androgene creature. It possesses within itself the capacity of polarization, but is not polarized except in manifestation. The particular and special polarization that we recognize being essentially physical. Thus, man, as a psychic or spiritual being, has an androgene core, and in the effort to establish equilibrium in his objective life, he chooses marriage. He selects his mate and attempts in this way to balance his own nature. Both persons in the marriage being actually seeking to balance their own internal lives. Through association, the two individuals are partly restored to their natural androgen state. The man, through association with the woman, becoming more sensitive and having certain vital experiences which would not be possible to him alone in his polarized condition, and the woman vice versa. Therefore, in all instances, again, marriage is an effort to establish equilibrium, which in turn means harmonious organization or integration. And just as the moderation of the mind is necessary for creativity on a spiritual level, so the union or moderation of opposites on the physical level is necessary for the generation of the human being physically. So our law of polarity operates also on these levels. The law of polarity has its polarization in our psychic lives, in our mental and in our consciousness and conscience. On the psychic level, a polarization, again, is this struggle between internals and externals, in which the individual is either an extrovert or an introvert. The extrovert moving excessively outward, the introvert moving excessively inward. Moderation meaning both a rich internal and external life, a situation difficult to attain. On the mental level, the equivalent of the extrovert is the so-called concrete thinker, the person whose mind is directed toward achievement of some objective in the physical or visible universe. The abstract thinker is one whose mental life is turned to the invisibles, to the creativities, to the philosophies, religions, sciences, arts, where the greater amount of subjective intellect is employed. Either polarization without compromise or complement from the other can lead to excessive imbalance. And a large part of psychological imbalance is simply due to the individual moving too far in one direction and thereby violating the law of equilibrium. It is therefore important that every person with heavy physical responsibilities should have artistic, aesthetic, and cultural avocational releases. It is also important that the idealist and the dreamer and the mystic should have physical responsibilities by which he is assisted to maintain equilibrium and balance in his conduct. That is one of the reasons why it has always seemed very unwise, and from my experience it has been proven so, for individuals to attempt to depart from responsibilities in search of higher ideals. These higher ideals should be built upon responsibilities, upon the victorious and complete acceptance of duty, and not upon a running away from the need of man to serve the unknown need of God. These things must work together, must cooperate, and build toward a proper picture and a proper pattern. Now, out of these principles, out of this law of polarity, leading to equilibrium, which is a great silence, comes another law, which is perhaps one of the most pleasant, the gentle laws, that we have to contemplate in life. And that is the law which we call harmony and rhythm. Now, in nature, as Havelock Ellis realized, life is a kind of dance. Life is a magnificent motion. The Chinese Taoist, in his concept of Tao, or universal being, recognized truth, God, reality, the road, all of the mysterious principles which he gathered into the term Tao. He recognized these as the great kun, or the eternal sound that goes on forever. And he also recognized this principle as the great rhythm, the great beauty that has neither beginning nor end. And out of harmony and rhythm has come man's concept of beauty. And law, perhaps, is never more perfectly revealed than by beauty. Now we can say, what is the law governing particularly the operation of harmony and rhythm? Well, I think probably we will agree that the most vital law associated with these things is mathematics. Therefore, the Pythagorean and Platonic schools admonished their disciples that no one who was ignorant of astronomy, mathematics, and music would enter the great schools of philosophy. Music, as an example of harmony and rhythm, is only one. We know, of course, Pythagoras is said to have been able to hear the music of the spheres, the sidereal or celestial music, the music that's played upon the great Veena of the god Shiva. Rhythm, perhaps, comes closest to us in the beat of the human heart. But everywhere in nature, there is harmony and rhythm revealing itself through the processes of law. Harmony is a very large word. We think of it mostly in terms of sound. But harmony means much more. Harmony means order, means equilibrium in one sense. Balance. It means the unfoldment of things with a perfection that is full of grace, full of exquisite beauty. And we discover law as beauty. One of the ways, traditionally, in which perhaps we make this discovery is in the pattern of the snowflake. Here we have immutable law revealing itself as exquisite beauty. We find it also in minute shell life and tiny living things like the radiolaria. We find it wherever nature is creating, in the distribution of leaves along the stem of a plant, in the petals of a flower. All these manifestations are beauty. We also observe it in the sunset, in the great vista of the plains, the mountains, and the sea. We also recognize that nature is never discordant, and the wildest abandon of color in a field of flowers will never include any jarring or unpleasant color notes. Everything blends, melds, and molds together into a highly acceptable symphony. Now, some intellectuals working on this problem have suggested that beauty is nothing more nor less than man's becoming accustomed to things, that the way things have always been must always be beautiful, whereas anything that deviates or breaks away is no longer beautiful. We have this, of course, in musical speculation and the introduction of dissonances, for which Richard Wagner, for one, was extremely famous. He attempted to prove that the dissonant intervals are also beautiful. For a time, he was bitterly attacked. Later, he was accepted, and it finally agreed that in spite of the unfamiliarity, there is actually in music no basic dissonance. Everything can be made beautiful if we know how. And if we use these intervals wisely and beautifully, they become beautiful. The law of harmony and rhythm also points out to us that life itself is a geometrical mystery, that the human soul is a geometrical marvel, that everything in life wants to be beautiful, presses forward to symmetry, and that law, wherever it has its perfect work, results in perfect beauty. The deformity, therefore, is in some way a limitation, a restriction, a falling short of nature's plan, and that even though perhaps nature must do a little experimenting in the effort, even experiments are beautiful in nature, which is more than we can say of futuristic art. But in any event, nature is forever moving in patterns that are strangely, grandly, and wonderfully acceptable to us. Standards of human beauty are forever changing, yet the quest for beauty is eternal. And the law of harmony and rhythm means that ultimately, that which is harmonious and that which is rhythmic must fulfill the need of beauty. Harmony is a little different from rhythm in the sense that rhythm represents interval or tempo, whereas harmony represents blending, the union of things. In this it changes or differs again from melody, for the melodic line represents a tune that is recognizable. But harmony is the bringing together of things, of tones, of patterns, themselves different, perhaps set in different tonal patterns, but all coming together in one magnificent blending, as a magnificent symphony of Beethoven. Thus harmony is achieved through the soul power. For in harmony we must call upon the full orchestration of universals. In harmony we must be able to conduct the orchestra. Each instrument must play its part, and we must bind them together until they become one living instrument, like one great, vital, living pipe organ. In our living and thinking and breathing and hoping and fearing, therefore, the ancients advised that in all things we should seek harmony, and that in all things we should attempt to attain rhythm. The ancient Greeks were much given to a very literal interpretation of symbolism. And our old friend Socrates, who was not perhaps our idea of the figure of the Apollo, was addicted to the Terpsichorean muse and always danced with his disciples in the early morning. It might not have been an aesthetic sight for others, but it was of great aesthetic satisfaction to Socrates, which, after all, was the important point. And so, seeking to move with life, to dance the dance of life, we must also realize that it is not only work, that it is not only labor, struggle, effort, magnificent challenge, but it is also a matter of grace. And the things done graciously and beautifully have a peculiar virtue in themselves. And to be done beautifully and graciously, they must be done harmonically and rhythmically. The human being's psychological integration is nowhere more evident than in the reaction upon conduct in terms of grace and harmony. The neurotic, the introvert, the psychotic, is seldom able to control his body in a rhythmic, harmonious way. His actions are abrupt, angular, broken, like his attitudes. And he does not have the wonderful sustaining power of uninterrupted motion. We all know that with an automobile, one of the greatest extravagances is stopping and starting. That it takes much more gasoline and electricity to get the car constantly going from a dead stop than it does to keep it running. It is the same way with the energy content of man. If the human being can flow from one action to another without interval, without break, without the sense of interruption, so that no matter what happens, it may cause a brief change in the program, but never an interruption, the person finds that his energy resources are conserved, because harmony and rhythm are the most economical ways of accomplishing things. And the moment intensity, the moment loss of harmony is experienced, there is loss of energy, loss of time, inefficiency. The individual is not up to his normal standard. Whereas if he moves quietly, rhythmically, harmoniously, graciously through life, he will find he can accomplish much more, because he will not be faced with repairs as a result of ill-considered or unreasonable attitudes. So harmony and rhythm move with us in every part of life. Worship is always or nearly always accompanied by music, often by dance, frequently by processional, by magnificent chants, masses, which have profound effect upon the individual because they are expressions of great rhythm and harmony. And religious music helps to set the tempo for the devout person, helps him to relax into the mood suitable for worship. The musical modes of the Greeks have similar meaning because they had modal music for practically every occupation and activity of man. And we know in modern musical therapy the importance of music in industry, of music in the home, in the school, in the hospital, because music helps the individual to restore a certain sense of harmony within his own nature. So in all things, the harmonious person is greatly rewarded, whereas the individual who has no harmony in his soul is already gravely punished and is burdened with duties, responsibilities for which he has very little gladness in his own makeup. And for that reason, he loses much of the privilege and joy of living. Now, out of these four laws, there comes another. And this law, again, is merely an expression of those that went before, using a curious combination of cause and effect, polarity, and harmony and rhythm. And this law emerges as one of the great laws of the ancients, the law which they recognized and which we have totally or almost totally rejected. And that is the great law of analogy. Analogy was to ancient man the universal key to all knowledge. And it was based upon the fact that nature is infinitely repeating its own processes. Leonardo da Vinci became one of the greatest exponents of the law of analogy. He found, for example, all the motions, stresses, and tensions of the human body captured in miniature in the human hand or in the human foot. He found all of society captured and held in the human face. He recognized that all things are alike in substance and principle, differing only in size and the number of their related parts. Thus, all creations suspended from one creative power, moving, therefore, from one basic archetypal pattern. The laws governing the universe must inevitably force all things to a vast internal similarity. was operating upon substances and elements, molding these substances and elements into innumerable structures. It can be discovered by the analysis of the structures, because all of them must have archetypal conformity with the vast pattern upon which they are designed or from which they are taken. Therefore, we have the great hermetic statement of this law, supposed to have been found by Alexander the Great in the tomb of Hermes Trismegistus in the valley of Hebron. And that is, this great law was inscribed upon an emerald. And it says, that which is above is like that which is below. That which is superior is like unto that which is inferior. This means that there is a tremendous archetypal sympathy between the universe and the electron. That actually the cell, the atom, each of these is a little world, and the world is the great cell, the great atom. That everything actually moves upon one basic key pattern. And who possesses the key to that pattern possesses the key to all knowledge. This means, or meant to the ancients, that if man could ever understand one thing completely, he would know all things. It's quite a challenge because he's never gotten very far, even on that project, but he's still working on it. But old alchemists gave us a little rather encouraging thinking on that process. They said, for example, that deity in its infinite wisdom had given man three books to read. One, the Holy Scriptures, the second, the universe, and the third, man himself. And that in these three books were the secrets of all things. The most difficult to explore would be the universe. The most difficult to intellectually understand would be the Scriptures. The simplest, most immediate, and that for which we have an inevitable and well-recognized sympathy is ourselves. Therefore, man actually possesses or contains within his own structure the key to all other things. That there is not one principle in space that is not somewhere in man. That there is no law operating in space which does not operate somewhere also in the compound construction of the human being. Consequently, the motive for perhaps for the great adage of antiquity, man know thyself. Man cannot always explore other things successfully. He can examine the rocks, but he loses the great geological lessons long before he has mastered them. Man may explore space, but still he comes only to the mystery of more worlds to conquer. He may study theologies endlessly, but they are somewhat strangely detached from his own experience, and there is in them so much conflict that man often becomes discouraged. But within himself, searching inwardly, exploring the mysterious recesses of his own total being, man has available the only thing he can really understand and the only thing he can really know, his own life. It must be that the answer is there. Otherwise, there could be no answer. For man can never live someone else's life, nor can he know with certainty the depths of the heart of another person. So all the answers, all the way from the shallow externals of his present ignorance to the deepest profundities of his divine origin, all these things must be within himself. And by recapitulation, infinitely repeated within himself. The mystery of his body must be in every drop of blood, the total of his consciousness in every nerve cell. Every organ must tell the story of all others. Every sense perception must contain the others. And the total human being, in his life and experience, must have within him all life, all experience, both relating to causes and effects. Through this contemplation, the human being, seeking to know the workings of the world, finds these workings wonderfully unfolded through his own personal nature. Thus the law of analogy helps him not only to recognize this wonderful concatenation, as we call it, or a sequential descent of similars, but it also helps him to be aware that all bodies are houses for souls. All souls are housed in bodies. That all things visible have their relationships to things invisible in the same manner, though differing perhaps in quantity, quality, or degree. That essentially all things have the same geometrical design, just like the septenary itself, which is diversified through every level and layer of human society and universal procedure. Thus the law of analogy enables us to study the greatest from the least, also enables us to approximate the structure of the universe as far as it is qualitatively concerned. The substances in terms of living essences by which the universe is sustained. All these things we come to know. Paracelsus was of the opinion also that because of these sympathies within our own natures, we had a bridge or binder between these similarities in ourselves and the greater archetypal patterns in space. Thus, if the human being could understand some motion, some energy, some principle within himself, he was then capable of the apperceptive experience of the universal correspondent. As the tuning fork contributes its tone to another fork of similar pitch, so the individual's participation, the energy of in himself of a certain quality, creates a sympathy with all energy of that quality, giving man the possibility of a cosmic experience of that energy through the discovery and experience of it within himself. These things he can do, but from the outside he can never conquer these energies, because he can never approach anything from the outside and know it. He may examine it, he may analyze it, he may come to some decision concerning its structure and form, but all things are known only from within. But from the withinness of himself, man is in harmony with the withinness of all other things. From the outside, he can never attain this rapport. So the law of analogy goes on and on through all the different departments of experience and life, and gives us a vital and important understanding. Now in your northern or Mahayana system of Buddhism, five of the celestial Buddhas are recognized. Two are concealed. In the human sensory gamut, five senses are functioning. Two are not. These two represent those yet to come. In the great racial evolution of man, five races have come. Two have yet to come. In the great continental distribution, five continents, two yet to come. Therefore, in the great septenary of laws, five have been revealed and two are concealed. Now, in your astronomical system of the ancients, there is reference to the seven planets. Yet the ancient did not know seven planets. He knew only five planets, and he added to these the luminaries, the sun and moon, to make seven. He was well aware that the sun and moon were not planets, but they became the shields, or the blinds, or the symbols for the two planets which were not then known. In the same way, there are five laws that we now know, and two laws that cannot be known to us until, through our own experience and through our own growth, we unfold the sensitivity of them, or to them, from within our own natures. They are operating, but we cannot yet differentiate them. Perhaps we shall learn something of them through our atomic researches, which are coming gradually and which will undoubtedly expand until ultimately we shall come face to face with universal principles and laws that we do not yet recognize. But the ancients recognized that there were seven laws, only five of which were known. Therefore, to complete their septenary of laws, they added two shells, or two symbols, symbolic laws, which are actually derived substantially from other laws, but which are now advanced to fill in the septenary and to cover for the ones that are not as yet known. For actually, the law of evolution actually covers the law of rebirth, and the law of cause and effect covers the law of karma. So our difference has been that we have taken these two laws, rebirth or reincarnation, and cause and karma, and we have declared them to represent laws operating upon the moral level of human conduct, and used these two to complete the septenary. The law of rebirth would be an inevitable correlative of evolution, because actually evolution, operating through cause and effect, must be the perpetual growth of things. And the perpetual growth of things contains within its own concept everything relating to the continuing improvement of forms and the re-embodying of life principles in forms until they attain their maturity or perfection. Therefore, reincarnation is to us the law of evolution applied to the moral and ethical life of the individual. And the law of karma is the law of cause and effect brought within the personal experience of the individual and his problems. These are the two laws that cover the greater laws that remain as yet unrevealed. So by means of them, we create the septenary. Now, what can we add at this time to a discussion of the law of reincarnation that would not more or less parallel material we have previously covered? There are some points, I think, that might be valuable, because we are now thinking in terms of a septenary of laws. And we are therefore assuming and affirming that these laws exist, and that these laws are necessary to the fulfillment of the primary law, and that all laws make evolution complete. For it is the root law, like the root race, or the root power, in relating to the other septenaries that we have considered. This law, the law of reincarnation and karma, these two laws, have one important peculiarity. We call them symbol laws, or blinds, or cover laws to conceal something else that we do not know. Buddhism would consider this highly correct, because it would tell us that these two laws, peculiarly applicable to man, exist on the level we know them only because of the mind of man. That reincarnation and karma, therefore, are man-made laws, yet related to and dependent upon almost completely two great universal laws. One of the reasons why this is true is because Buddhism points out that these laws are both based upon man's acceptance of certain illusions in his own nature. The law of rebirth is based upon man's acceptance of the need to survive as a person. This law is not primarily involved in the original concept of evolution, because evolution has nothing to do with man surviving. Evolution has only to do with God perfecting. And man, in this pattern, becomes only an instant or a moment in the evolution of a divine being. But man, with his own peculiar attachments to things, considers his own survival as an individual far more important than his ultimate renunciation of selfhood in order that deity may be perfected. Thus man, striving desperately to survive as a being, sets in action mental processes which carry forward from embodiment to embodiment in the form of an intellectual continuity of self-consciousness. Thus the individual wills himself to exist as himself. And as long as this will, or this remote but powerful desire, continues, the individual is surviving as an individual, rather than accepting the Buddhist concept that actually only reality is immortal, and that therefore man's ultimate attainment is absorption in reality. But the law of reincarnation was long accepted in the East, drifted over the caravan routes, and finally through the travels of Pythagoras and the conquests of Alexander and the journeys of Apollonius, finally reached the Mediterranean area and the Aegean to influence our entire southern European and North African cultures. This coming into contact with the Western concept of life was modified to sustain the idea of man's gradual growth through re-embodiment into a divine being, into a separate godling, having infinite personal powers. This concept has influenced our immortality theories from the beginning of Western culture. But this, to the Eastern mind, is only a veil, because our great goal is not that the individual shall be perfect, but that the total shall achieve its own completeness. And that in this process, races, creatures, beings, innumerable, are created and vanish into limbo. Nothing real ever dying, nothing unreal ever surviving. And that finally, in the infinite ultimate of things, we shall discover this spark of life within ourselves is not our own, but is the eternal spark blazing in us. Ultimately, through service of this spark and final identification with it, we fulfill our own destiny. This, however, will not be a problem of too great importance in the vital experience of the individual. He could not separate this spark from his own personality by any effort of the will. He can only, through the fulfillment or keeping of laws, finally relax his immoderations on an egoistic or egocentric level until gradually, through the increase of total integration or placidity within his own consciousness, he will relax his selfness and, like the mystic, become more and more aware of the God-selfness, and in so doing will ultimately reach this point of renunciation in which he can say with fullness of spirit, "Not my will, but thine be done." And when that occurs, actually, deity takes over and becomes the great power, the reality, rather than merely for average human beings, the deity is little better than a source of energy supply. We have not yet recognized the spiritual importance of the deity value in ourselves. The law of karma, of course, is the law of cause and effect, applied on the level of personal conduct, on the level of an individual having moral and ethical individualism. In nature, cause and effect follows great cyclic patterns, patterns which arise in the archetypal forms of universal procedure. In man, cause and effect is most closely linked with self-conduct. In the individual, he recognizes that he himself sets into motion certain causes the effects of which he must be ready to endure. If for some reason he does not desire to endure the effect, then he must cease to produce the cause. On one occasion, Buddha, discussing this with one of his disciples, the disciple explained to him all the sorrows and miseries through which he was passing, and the Buddha explained to him that it was the working out of karma. And the tired and harassed sufferer asked if there wasn't something he could do about it. And Buddha gently patted him on the shoulder and said, "Yes, brother, endure it." And once the cause is set in motion, wisdom is the gentle, cheerful endurance. The only great thing to remember is, don't set it in motion again. Because the first time it can be anybody's fault, apparently, but the second time it is distinctly our own. If, therefore, at any time in life, we are in the presence of consequences which can no longer be prevented by the correction of their causes, then they must be accepted. The lesson that they contain must be accepted, and the individual must preserve this information and keep it available against a possible repetition of the causes. No cause will produce an effect in excess of itself, nor deficient of itself. And no effect, when it becomes a cause, can produce a cause inconsistent with itself. Life goes on, experience goes on, as long as cause and effect go on. Yet there must be, according to Buddhism, a gradual diminution of this cycle. It cannot go forever. It may go for a long time, but in eternity, all things are bound together into a complete and finished product, whatever that may be. So, Buddha points out that wherever the individual, in the presence of an effect, is able to produce only a commendable reaction from himself. If, for example, in the presence of a great karmic debt that must be paid, which may result in adversity, or trial, or even pain, or loss, the individual becomes indignant, fights back, blames others, becomes intolerant, vindictive. These things immediately set in motion another chain of circumstances. This is where the dharmic reaction from within himself becomes the cause of a new karmic sequence. If, however, as Buddha taught his disciples, in the presence of this type of an unpleasant situation, the individual graciously, kindly, gently, lovingly releases, holds no ill, is patient in all things, takes no extreme attitude, but attempts only to grow, to ask what the lesson is and how best he can learn it, it is obvious that his dharma has now set in motion another type of causation entirely. This causation can never produce an effect different from itself. And if the individual, out of an emergency, has set a causation of peace in motion, that causation must ultimately likewise produce its own end, and its end must be peaceful. Consequently, wherever it is humanly possible to reduce the intensity of the impact of an effect upon consciousness, the individual reduces the karmic load that must go forward. Wherever he understands and accepts, wherever he meets his problem, with that which is the nearest to moderation, where he maintains equilibrium, never, if possible, falling away from peace within his own consciousness, he then cannot set in motion further conflict. If through general and gentle watchfulness, his entire life becomes less negatively intense, less combative, less destructive, less critical, he cannot have the same type of karma that he would have if he has not achieved these ends. Consequently, through moderation, he neutralizes the power of karma, because karma acts upon only one factor, action-reaction. Action must produce reaction. Non-action cannot produce reaction, because we cannot set in motion anything as a result of absolute equilibrium. Gradually, therefore, as Buddha pointed out, the disciple seeking ultimate liberation comes to the causeless embodiment, the embodiment in which the final residue of debt must be paid, but no new causation is set in motion, in which the individual sets nothing moving which can possibly come back to him as pain, sorrow, loss, or death. Having attained this more or less complete and perfect equilibrium, the karmic overload is continuously diminished. The individual then has two choices in his karma. That choice which is the northern Buddhistic concept, namely, the possibility of attaining a paradisical state, the Sukhavati of the northern Buddhist. The paradisical state is the individual who, in the payment of karma, creates only happy karma to come. He does so many good deeds. He is so generous, he is so kind, he is so loving, he is so faithful, he is so just and so true, that all that he can have in the form of reaction is pleasurable. Therefore, he may have the famous embodiment where he became, in the legend, the king, and had all wonderful things for himself. He was so wonderful, so wise, and so good that he was very happy until being a king turned his head, then he got into trouble again. But, in other words, the paradise is the result of good deeds, producing their natural consequences, because nature is not at all partial. It just as much loves to reward as to punish. But Buddha goes further and says that the good deeds also have about them a certain foolishness, for very few people can carry happiness without ultimately destroying it or spoiling it in some way. Out of fortune and good time comes arrogance. Out of a life in which everything goes well comes laziness. And one by one, our little virtues are swept away by the misuses we make of them. So Buddha taught that the only ultimate release lay in the suspension of all consequence, in which the life, being a condition of inward tranquility, causes the individual to inherit no debt but peace and silence. And having attained to this end, he is therefore free from the wheel of karma. Having attained such attainments, the individual also moves back only into the great stream, the stream of the law carrying with it the growth of the divine being itself. And all things other than this and less valuable are slowly cast away. So we have this structure of laws. And in these laws, we find the roots of patterns. The painter uses them, the musician uses them, everyone uses them. They are the ever-present help in time of trouble. And it is good for us, as human beings and as thoughtful human beings, to take our refuge in the law. Not to take our hope in the fact that we can evade it. Not to take our hope that some other dispensation no longer makes it necessary, but face the simple fact that who lives the life shall know the doctrine. That in keeping the law, we give ourselves the greatest good that we can enjoy. that by fulfilling the law in all its ways, we become aware that the law in its totality is a kind of lengthened shadow of God itself. And that in the love of law, in the embracing of law as the greatest good, we reach out and touch the very substance of the creating power. For the law is God made manifest in his works. And those who obey this great pattern are the chosen ones. For if we love God, we will keep his commandments. And these commandments are his laws, not spoken from a mountain, but revealed forever in the lives and hearts and souls of creatures. Laws that we live with every day, that rule the plant, that rule everything. And if we quietly and systematically and thoughtfully study and learn to love these laws, we will find that we live in a much better world than we ever suspected, a world in which there is more goodness than we have ever known, and a world which protects us so completely that perhaps it is not an extravagance to say that this power watches and notes each sparrow's fall. There is nothing that happens in the universe that law is not sufficient for, and which is not in itself lawful. And it is this lawfulness which is our hope, because it is lawful for us and right for us to grow, to fulfill, to achieve integrity and security, and to find the greater good we seek for. And with this kind of religious philosophy behind the concept of law, I think we can have greater inducements, universally and cosmically speaking, for being law-abiding citizens. And wherever we can, obey the law and keep the peace. And the peace we should keep, most of all, is that within ourselves. And by doing these things, all other good things come in their proper time. Well, the time is up.